The conversation continues with State of the Nation's Brian McClain and Timothy Shea on today's News Talk TNT.
You're watching State of the Nation on today's News Talk with Brian McClain and Timothy Shea. We're live from Texas and New York. You can visit us on the web at tntradio.live. Brian, welcome to State of the Nation.
Hey, great to be here. Hour two, you know, hour one always goes by so fast. It's like, wow, how did we get here so quickly? But here we are.
Here we are. And somewhere I hear Norm McDonald saying, so OJ got to play Chutes and Ladders with St. Peter. I don't think he won.
Probably not.
You know, Norm McDonald, for those that don't know, was fired off of Saturday Night Live for refusing to stop telling OJ jokes. He's constantly stood up for Nicole Brown, her family, Ron Goldman and his family. And the powers that be at NBC said, nope, OJ's our boy. And so you got to go, Norm. But I think Norm's having the last laugh, Brian.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, OJ has left the building. So that happened today.
No appeal possible. Final judgment rendered, no appeal possible. You know, nobody hopes that anybody gets sent down south, but, you know, we don't get sent down south. We send ourselves. And hopefully that didn't happen to OJ. Hopefully he had a change of heart before he passed. But I do want to extend condolences to his family because his children, of course, obviously loved him and are grieving at his passing. Only 76 years old. I got to see OJ play twice. The first time was uneventful. He only ran for 57 yards. But the second time, although he only ran for 57 yards, he set the season touchdown record at 23. And it was a nefarious Buffalo Bills fan, Brian, that threw a snowball at Chuck Foreman. Chuck had four touchdowns, and if he'd scored one more, he would have tied OJ. But a Bills fan threw a snowball at Chuck Foreman, hit him in the eyeball, and knocked him out of the game.
Wow, that's quite the experience there, Timothy.
You know, it's amazing. You want to talk about a modern Greek tragedy? Here's a guy that had everything going for himself, right? He played 2 years at USC, won a national championship, won a Heisman Trophy, Walter Camp Trophy. He set the season. He's the only running back in NFL history to rush for 2,000 yards in a 14-game season. He used to tell people he wasn't black. He was OJ. He was Tiger Woods before Tiger Woods. He transcended race. And it's just sad, Brian, to see how a man's demons can be his fatal flaw, be what leads him down to destroying his reputation.
Indeed. My main OJ experiences were simply being a fan of the movie The Naked Gun and then someone who watched the infamous Bronco chase and the ensuing trials as a youth.
I think that the white Bronco just sold at auction for some ridiculous amount of money, too.
Oh, my goodness. I'm not surprised.
And of course, you know, Johnny Cochran has some company. Johnny, who came up with if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. Well, anybody that's ever played golf on a rainy day and tried to put on their golf glove the next day after it had been wet knows that leather shrinks once it's wet. That glove, of course, had been soaked with blood. And then they made OJ try it on wearing a surgical glove because it had been soaked in blood and didn't want to get AIDS from the glove. So, of course, the glove didn't fit. And the jury did acquit, Brian.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that upset a lot of people. I was old enough to notice that definitely upset a lot of people around me in my world.
And last but not least, OJ's responsible for giving us the scourge on the cultural landscape known as the Kardashians. Bruce Jenner might still be a dude if Robert Kardashian hadn't been OJ's attorney.
Oh, wow, Timothy, I had never even thought of that one before. I don't even know what to say, but good point.
We connect the dots here at State of the Nation.
Yes. Wow.
And yep, we have more right after this quick word.
talk that matters.
For once, we just need to do what's best for this damn country and not what's best for the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right. Well, lots of news coming out of Chicago, Illinois. My goodness. And we're joined by Raymond Lopez. He's an American politician who's currently a member of the Chicago City Council, serving as alderman of the 15th Ward there in Chicago, Illinois. It's great to see you again, Raymond. Thanks for joining us on State of the Nation. How are you?
Gentlemen, it's my pleasure to be back again. Hope you're well.
Yes, yes, we're very happy to see you. Now, so much going on in Chicago. I'm going to throw this one at you just to kick us off. I want to know what's big on your radar, but I saw this one this morning and I knew you were going to be on the program. So the CDC sends a response team to Chicago migrant shelter because of a measles outbreak. Now, this I find extremely interesting because we're just, you know, experienced the whole COVIDian era, right? Where it was like, you know, you had to apologize with great shame if you sneezed in public or, you know, if you weren't wearing the ritual muzzle. But apparently when it comes to unfettered migration, we're not so concerned about it, even if we have large outbreaks of measles or whatever.
You know, the crazy part was that during COVID, it was mandatory vaccinations and requirements for your workplace for masks and all of that. And if you didn't, especially if you were a government worker, you risk being fired from your position. Now dealing with the migrants where we've seen measles, mumps, and now confirmed tuberculosis, you know, vaccinations is optional. We're about respecting human dignity and all of that great stuff that never was afforded the same to Americans during the pandemic. But now that's the concern of the day here. I think that what we're starting to see now is some realization that all of that gaslighting has had a real serious and negative impact on the public health and safety and well-being of not just the migrant asylum seekers, but of everyday Chicagoans who've had to coexist with these individuals in their communities and are now seeing alerts about measles and other infectious diseases on buses, in schools, and in other public places.
You know, what's happened to Chicago breaks my heart. It's one of my favorite cities. I used to love going to Chicago. I almost moved there. And to see what is happening to the good people of Chicago, because, you know, these are great Midwestern, hardworking people. It doesn't matter what neighborhood you're in, whether you're on the north side, the south side, the southwest side where you are and in the 15th Ward. These are all great people. And yet it almost seems as though the government has everyone's interests at heart, except for the citizens of Chicago. What's going on there?
Yes, it definitely feels as though our politics has taken a turn away from the neighborhoods. And indeed, I was just part of a lecture series that I heard yesterday where, you know, the old dichotomy of politics was that it was always about the economics. What's good for you? Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And those kind of arguments that we're used to. And now it is changing into this social agenda political narrative that, you know, you cannot really compromise or deal with because you're so worried about someone else's dignity that you forget what's in your own best interest sometimes. And it's sad that we're seeing that amplified here in the most American of American cities while it's being run by the Democratic Socialists who've hijacked the party, hijacked government, and are basically gaslighting their way through their first term in power.
Yeah, it makes me think of Mao's Cultural Revolution. You know, I just started this streaming program the other night, popular one on Netflix. I can't recall the name of it, but one of the opening scenes, it shows basically a public struggle session happening, you know, and there's a professor just being, you know, a professor's wife being forced to turn against him. A daughter is forced to watch while he's, you know, beaten by, you know, college age people, beaten to death, because he won't agree with their lies, you know. He won't agree to shuffle the truth aside for the social agenda. Why do you think it is that Americans can't see that when we have, this is the country that has so many immigrants and so many people from so many places? I've got friends and listeners out there and viewers who have wrote me and talked to me about why their parents moved them here from communist countries. And they can see it, but somehow the wool, I guess, has been pulled over much of America's eyes.
I think we're forgetting our roots, to be perfectly honest with you, in this country as the great-grandson of somebody who came here across the border with no papers, brought his family and his pregnant wife, who ultimately was my grandfather, gave birth to my grandfather. You know, they were aspiring to be Americans. There was something that they were wanting to be a part. And right now, society, and in particular, all of our overly educated young adults are focusing on trying to be a universal country that has completely lost its identity, that we're trying to be all things to all people and forgetting who we are. And in doing so, it's dividing us. We are falling down the social media rabbit holes where everyone who opposes you is evil and corrupt and should be canceled as opposed to just talked to. And we're finding our not only our politics, but our families, everyone is becoming further and further apart, trying to be closer to what they think we should be as opposed to what we are. No, we're losing ourselves in the effort to try and be everything to all people. And if you stand for everything and believe in and try to make everyone happy, you will fall for everything. And that's what we're seeing happen to our own society right now, and to a lesser extent across the world.
It really is. We just had Craig Deleuze from Sacramento, California out on talking about how, despite all research to the contrary, they've raised the minimum wage for fast food workers to $20 now. And of course, it's going to have a disparate impact on young Black and Hispanic men. It always does. 6.6% increase in Black and Hispanic unemployment for every 10% increase in minimum wage. That's the historical number. And it seems as though Democrats are making the same mistake with gun control. We haven't had a single mass shooting that hasn't been in a gun-free zone. Churches, schools, libraries, it's on and on and on. The data are clear. They've been in for a while. FBI even admits it. Where you have robust exercise of Second Amendment rights, you have lower crime. And where you have extreme gun control, you have the highest crime. And Chicago, unfortunately, just like New York City, has incredibly high crime because it has such strict gun control laws. A nurse coming home from a late shift can't protect herself walking home from the L. A father can't protect his wife and children, and yet the criminals all have guns and get to use them with impunity, resulting in one of the highest murder rates in the country. Is Chicago going to finally recognize reality and let its citizens exercise their Second Amendment rights?
You know, I don't think Chicago will ever get to that point. As long as we continue to have this false notion that, you know, the gun problem on our streets can be solved by disarming not only the citizenry, but the police. We just had a situation in the city of Chicago where a police video was released of an altercation between police pulling over an individual for cause and the driver pulling out a weapon and shooting at the police officers, injuring one of the police officers. And the outcry isn't that the driver fired 11 rounds at officers, striking one through the wrist. The outcry, and forced outcry, has been that the officers responded by shooting back. That is the kind of nonsensical environment that we're living in. And I think that one of the things that is missing from not just this debate, but many debates, particularly when it comes to the extremes of both political parties that seem to be driving the agenda, is that the thing that is missing most is common sense. It's just the sheer basic understanding of right and wrong and the willingness to stand up and say, this is right and this is wrong. We are always trying to create a false narrative just to pit people to get against each other, because that seems to be the only way that politicians on the extremes can get elected, by placating to the most extreme of extremes just to make it through whatever primary or whatever that they have, and not necessarily being truthful to their electorate, to their constituents, or to the communities that they serve.
Yes, yes, absolutely. We're going to take a brief break here, but on the other side of the break, I want to talk a little bit more about the migrant situation. I've seen a couple of different things I'd like to get your opinion on. So hold the line while we take this break with today's News Talk TNT.
I'm Sandra, this is Jorge, and we were adopted in 2019. I remember when they first came to us, Michael was already a teenager. The whole cliche of, they're so lucky to have you guys, and it's
no.
The other way around. They have changed our family for the better. They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
A hoax about carbon dioxide in the climate has caused a global energy and economic disaster. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
All right. We're joined by Raymond Lopez in this segment here. And Timothy, I'm curious, did you see this video? It was going around in the social media feeds. And I think it was happening in a Chicago airport. I'm going by memory here, but there was a representative of, you know, some NGO or the city or something. And he was basically telling a whole room full of people, would you like to go anywhere? We will pay for you to go anywhere but here in the city. You'll do much better in New York. You'll do much better in Toronto. It was like this crazy it didn't even feel realistic. It's like, what is happening right here? Some of these people have been bussed up from here in Texas. I mean, that really says a lot about the whole sanctuary city profile, doesn't it?
I saw that, and I also saw the video where private security guards, they sectioned off, you know, the pole and curtain dividers that they use at trade shows and for high school proms in the gym and whatnot. They had it was black curtains, walled off an entire section of one of the terminals at O'Hare, and private security guards were preventing people, reporters, from asking any questions, from videoing, from interviewing anybody. It's almost as though they know that this is wrong and need to keep it from public consciousness, Raymond.
Well, I think without question, you know, the administration has done its very best to try and keep people in the dark about what's going on all levels, whether it's the total number of individuals that are coming into this country at the border, whether it's in California, whether Arizona or Texas, to how much money we're actually spending on these individuals or what their living conditions are that we are as taxpayers paying for. That airport scenario is just one of 27 different shelter operations in the city of Chicago that has, in culmination with other programs, cost taxpayers at the state, county, and federal levels over $1.2 billion year to date. And it's an obscene amount of money with no oversight and with no end in sight, as the city of Chicago looks to spend nearly $400 million in 2024 and is already planning on what the cost will be come 2025.
Wow. Raymond, did you see this footage of, I don't know who it was, but in a room, it may have been the airport, telling a bunch of illegal migrants, hey, you should go to New York. You'll have better opportunities over there. We'll take you to Tulsa. We'll take you to New York. Was that happening in Chicago? Do you know anything about that? I mean, that really kind of says something about the whole sanctuary city idea.
I believe that was in Denver, where they were actually encouraging to New York or Chicago. Because we had not yet said the inn is closed, don't come here anymore.
You're right. Thank you for that correction. It was Denver.
And that
for
was
sure.
So how did city saying
so how do you feel about that happening Sorry, I don't mean to keep stepping on you, but how do you feel about that happening and them suggesting? I knew Chicago was involved. How do you feel about them suggesting so many people come to Chicago when you've already got so many?
Well, you know, it speaks volumes to the idea of living your values, right? And we hear that constantly, especially from some of my more liberal, progressive colleagues, that, you know, we have to live our values until it becomes real. While this is an academic exercise, it's very easy for us to espouse these views of being welcoming to all, regardless of your criminal status or your immigration status, as long as it's somebody else's problem. Once it becomes your problem, then all of a sudden, all bets are off and go somewhere else. We become liberal NIMBYs, if you will.
Yeah,
I think it's a little... go ahead.
No, virtue signaling is always fun in games. You know, I always used to laugh at Cambridge declaring itself a nuclear-free zone. It's like, well, you do realize that MIT has a nuclear reactor, right? And so that was the great joke. But it's always, you know, these grand pronouncements that don't mean anything. I used to summer on Martha's Vineyard, and I had a grand laugh when Ron DeSantis just flew one plane load of newcomers up to Martha's Vineyard, and all of a sudden it was this mass crisis. It's like, you people are the biggest hypocrites possible. But here's my concern. Again, it's for the people in Chicago, the neighborhoods. America is the most generous nation on earth. We've got a very robust social services network here, and we also give more in foreign aid than any other country on the planet. But resources are finite. How much of a negative impact is this wave of illegal immigration over the last 3 years had on the average Chicagoan who's struggling to put food on the table through the good auspices of the government?
Well, I think the issue that we have here, and let me be clear, is that Chicago has always been willing to meet any challenge thrown its direction and rise to the occasion.
City big shoulders.
It's the great thing about our city. But at the same time, the message that has been said loudly throughout the communities is that it's one thing to help these individuals, but charity must start at home. And if you could find $150, $200, $600 million to spend on them, you should have been able to find that money to spend on our own communities first, to address some of those social ills that we have been dealing with, like the degradation of the family unit, particularly in the South and West sides and in the African-American community. Find ways to break generational gang violence in the Latino communities that has been a stranglehold for two generations, to look at ways to invest in our neighborhoods. And all of that money that we're talking about now apparently never existed before the migrants showed up, which we know was a falsehood. But the answer has been the same. And what many of the community have said loudly and clearly to every elected official is that this is not about being anti-immigrant. This is about putting Chicagoans first. Solve our ills, address our individuals, rebuild our economic corridors, particularly those that were shut down through the pandemic, and then let's talk about what we could do for everybody else. That is not a hard sell for the citizens of the city of Chicago.
It seems to make sense. You know, we've been looking at crime rates and numbers over here at the show for a couple of weeks now. We've been, you know, taking little segments here and there. And one of the things that we've learned in the last couple of weeks is that since the DOJ no longer requires police departments to send their violent crime statistics to them, it's sort of a would you please now. Your city is on the list of cities that have submitted zero records to the Department of Justice when it comes to murder and violent crimes, assaults, etc. And the DOJ is putting out information saying that crime is down in the United States while they're not collecting data from Chicago, Baltimore, Los Angeles, New York, and a couple others. That sends a pretty murky message, doesn't it?
I mean, if only the IRS worked that way when claiming my taxes every year. Well, I created no income. I'm good. We're good, IRS. Don't worry about it.
Right.
But we know that's not the case. And I think it definitely sends a false narrative on the national scale about the impact of crime and violence at a time when we already know that reporting is down simply because people do not call 911 anymore after seeing the liberal left policies of the public, the prosecutors, the state's attorneys throughout the big city. authorities that simply do not charge criminals anymore. The disconnect between the public and public safety is widening, and it's having a severe and noticeable impact, regardless of how we report it or not. But the fact that anyone would try to use that as an election selling point, that crime is down in this country simply because no one reports it anymore, shows just how desperate people are for a win in an election season.
Yeah. Yeah, that says a lot right there. It definitely says a lot, because we're seeing the same thing with jobs. We're seeing the same thing with finance. It's just like across the board, you know, it's like the government's been reading Bill Gates' favorite book, How to Lie to People with Statistics. Now, Raymond, if you don't mind holding the line, we'll do another 5 minutes with you after a brief headline here with today's News Talk at TNT.
We interrupt this program.
Here we go.
This is huge,
huge, huge news.
Huge, huge,
huge news.
Huge. You need to listen to this.
Now, TNT Radio
For
News.
TNT, this is James O'Neill. Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, has been detained in London's Belmarsh prison for 5 years, a situation Amnesty International described as a mockery of the USA's international law obligations. Russia is contemplating the deployment of its intermediate-range nuclear-capable missiles, possibly alongside China, in response to the United States' revival of such weapons, according to the Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio, or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's News Talk. This is TNT Radio.
Raymond, a lot of people have heard the term alderman, but they don't really know how Chicago's city government works. You've got 50 districts and an alderman or alderwoman for each. I was looking at a map of your district, the 15th, and it looks like a little Space Invader character from an old 16-bit video game. It's gerrymandered in every direction. And in fact, you abut six other districts. How does your district hang together with the neighborhoods? Because you've got West Englewood, Brighton Park, Back of the Yards, Chicago Lawn, Canaryville, and Gage Park. And some of them are very far apart from each other. So how does the district hang together? How do those neighborhoods work together with each other? And how do you work with the six aldermen whose districts abut the 15th?
Well, if you ever played the game Pitfall, I look like one of those alligators in the swamp, and that 16-bit encryption there. But yes, so I was one of the wards that was heavily gerrymandered in the last remap. But what I've been able to do in my ward is all of those communities are not only geographically different, they're also economically and ethnically different as well. You know, right. You have some communities that are heavily Latino, heavily African-American, heavily Caucasian, predominantly Irish and white ethnic, as well as high immigrant and undocumented populations as well. And what I've been able to do, Tim, is really focus on what matters to everybody. And it's usually they want to feel safe in their communities. They want their children to be able to grow up. They'd like to find jobs in their neighborhoods. And they'd like to be able to create a life in the community that they choose. Now, that might vary in order depending on the neighborhood, but basically everyone has the same goals and visions, and they just want help getting to that point. And rather than focus on trying to divide people, I just choose to focus on where we are similar. Now, the unfortunate thing is having six different neighbors with six different views and half of them having far more liberal views than myself, you know, that often causes us some consternation, especially in dealing with some of the generational issues like gang and drug violence that we see in our communities. Because I believe in accountability and punishment, where some of my neighbors believe in unicorns and rainbows. So I think that, you know, what we've been able to show is that there's a different approach that can be had. And we like giving people the opportunity to see that live and in full display every single day.
Imagine that. I mean, that sounds like what Americans would hope for and expect when it comes to someone representing their community. You know, look for the things that work, look for the opportunities that work all around, you know, for all those different groups and neighborhoods, look for the pain points and alleviation for them. I mean, that's what a lot of people come to this country expecting. You know, they come here and they expect, like, that's the sort of governance, that's the sort of politics, and that it's, you know, generally a Christian nation, so there's a certain, you know, golden rule sort of mindset. But then people come here and they discover, oh my gosh, it's not like that everywhere. So, you know, where you're at, and that, you know, that's why we love talking to you and others like yourself that come here. Like, I mean, we'd love to talk to some of these people that aren't representing their constituents too. Don't get me wrong. They just don't take our phone calls. but yeah, I mean, how
I'm a lawyer.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm sure you've tried to get them on the phone too. But we got a couple minutes left. So tell us, you know, leave us with some final thoughts and, you know, your response to that, because I think that's an important factor. You know, representation is something that seems to be waning in this country as it is on the precipice right now.
Well, you know what I find on all levels of government is that elected officials tend to be more focused on the narrative than they are focusing on their constituents. That especially when it comes to the national stage, there's a push to just be a part of the go along, get along gang, stick to the party line and just focus on what you need to do to raise money and get elected. The loss is for the people that are choosing these elected officials because they're no longer part of the equation anymore. They're not listened to. They're not talked and engaged with, not just to, but with, about the problems that they're seeing in the communities. And the only way that we can actually address things in this country, whether it's on the national, state, or local levels, is by starting conversations with a place of truth, being able to discuss and disagree, and show people how to be civil, even when you don't believe in what the other person is saying. That art must be reintroduced in the body politic of this country if we're to continue to be a beacon of democracy moving forward. I think that social media and some of the other constructs that are recently emerging are detracting from that conversation and are standing in the way of our ability to achieve and maintain our greatness. Because if everything revolves and devolves into cancel culture-like mentality, you will never again have a civil conversation in this country if that's what it takes to be a part of politics.
Well said. Well said, sir. Raymond Lopez, thank you so much for joining us here at State of the Nation. Your work is very much appreciated nationwide, I tell you that. And we'll look forward to having you on back again, hopefully to discuss some good news coming out of Chicago and Illinois.
Well, we have plenty of great things coming up, so I look forward to bridging that gap sooner rather than later.
All right, we'll do it right here on State of the Nation. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
My name's Stacy. I'm 57, and I was adopted in 2020.
We were adopted in 2019.
And we were adopted in 2021.
We had a house, and it sounds crazy, but it wasn't a home. The one thing that Jake and Emma brought is it became a home.
When I met Dakota, he had just turned 14.
You weren't there for the first this and the first that. I missed the first words, but we got a lot of other firsts.
Watching her say, oh my God, I cannot believe I got my license. And she's like, I passed. And I'm like, girl.
See them grow. It is.
They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
You and you.
Kids in the middle.
What I thought was a complete life was nowhere near complete. But it is now.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Food isn't just fuel to live, it's fuel to grow. My family relied on public assistance to help provide meals for us. These meals fueled my involvement in theater and the arts as a child, which fostered my love for acting. The Feeding America network of food banks helps millions of people put food on the table. When people are fed, futures are nourished. Join the movement to end hunger, and together we can open endless possibilities for people to thrive. Visit feedingamerica.org/act now.
The conversation continues with State of the Nation's Brian McLean and Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT.
We were just talking about Oregon's reversal on drug criminalization, how after just 3 years, they've decided to change course and recriminalize hard drugs. You know, many of us told them that wasn't going to work. And there are people there that are saying, no, you just didn't give it enough time. Well, joining us to discuss this is retired Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Chief Patrick J. Jordan, a 38-year veteran in the nation's largest sheriff department. Chief Jordan currently serves on the foundation board for the Los Angeles Mission, which serves the need of homeless in downtown Los Angeles's Skid Row. You can follow him on X at LASD Jordan. It's LASD JORDAN. Welcome back to State of the Nation, Chief Jordan.
Hey, thank you for having me back. Go ahead. Yeah, you know, the whole Oregon thing is an interesting thing, and why I got interested in it, because, you know, I'm based in LA and I do commentary on my show, Briefing with the Chief, and I focus on Gascon and the fallouts of his policies here, right? And the thing that interested me about Oregon is Oregon 3 years ago decriminalized the possession and use of narcotics, and now they recriminalized them. And so I said, okay, well, what's going on there, right? So I looked them up, and of course, their overdose deaths are skyrocketing. Their theft is going up. And of course, the derelicts, or whatever you want to call them, the homeless, the urban decay is occurring in their big cities. And the politicians there, because it's a blue state, a progressive state, are running scared. It's election year. So they decide to recriminalize. They don't go back to felonies, but they go back to misdemeanors. And one of the things that caught my attention is, I think Politico did an article that said they didn't go far enough. They should have done what Portugal did and put a bunch of treatments in place. And then it would have been nirvana. You know, we'd had rainbows and unicorns, like your last guest said, and it would have been perfect. Now, why it's connected to LA is, now Los Angeles or California, they didn't decriminalize, but they reduced the punishment for possession and the use of narcotics. However, and that was written by George Cohen, Gascon, Prop 47. However, when George Gascon became the DA in LA, he re-characterized those crimes as, instead of drug and alcohol crimes, as addiction crimes, and he hasn't filed one since he's been a DA. So essentially, in the county of Los Angeles, we've embraced the same policy as Oregon. So now you got three places you can look at. Well, how has this policy worked out? Well, in LA, when Prop 47 started, we had, like, I think it was 1,100 or maybe 1,200 overdose deaths, and fentanyl was a very small part of those. And fast forward to after 2 years of George Gascon, it was an upward rise, and then George Gascon got in office, and then you saw a spike in LA. So when George Gascon got in office, it was like 2,700 overdose deaths. Then after 2 years in office, it spiked to 3,200 overdose deaths. So that's an incredible increase. Now, Oregon experienced the very same thing. And so then I decided, well, let me go look at this Portugal model where the unicorns had showed up and the rainbows are there to see what's going on. And then when you actually dig into it and you look at a contrarian point of view there, what they're experiencing is they went from a 7% adult usage of narcotics to a 12%, right? They see an increase in overdose deaths. They're also seeing some urban decay. So very same things that we're seeing here. So they invested a lot of money. They kept it down for a while, but now it's spiking upward. And even Portugal is beginning to rethink it. But here's the interesting thing about Portugal, which is scary, and that every city who embraces these policies, certainly every state, need to think about, that the critics of the Portugal model said, you know what? These nonprofits who are supposed to be reducing addiction, remember, because here's the thing. We got law enforcement and the criminal justice system out of the narcotics game. It's all treatment, right? We brought the social workers and the doctors and the nurses in, right? That's what Portugal did. And so now we're seeing the usage go up in Portugal. And when these nonprofits are confronted about this, they said, well, you know, we really believe that lifetime addiction should be a human right. That is what they're saying in Portugal. And the critics are saying, we have normalized drug use in Portugal. And that is the direction it had Oregon not changed course, it was headed. And if we are stuck with George Gascon any longer, LA County is heading that in that direction. But that's why those are three great data sets to look at. And you can see the spike in all three locations, and you can see the same result, different time frames in all three locations.
So under that model, does a addict, a user, someone who's had an incident, someone who's had a visit from social workers or, you know, whoever, do they have to, do they ever have to go take the treatment, or do they just encourage them to seek treatment, offer them treatment? Is it completely voluntary? And how important, how does that differ from the old model where somebody would, you know, go to jail or a place, you know, where they have to go and get, you know, the stuff out of their system and then maybe get offered treatment? Like, can we juxtapose that a little bit?
Well, here's the thing about it. I think the area that we made a mistake in when we were tough on narcotics and tough on crime, because I ended up being in charge of programs in the LA County jail system for about 5 years. And one of the things I helped to implement was a drug and alcohol treatment program in the jails. We had drug education programs, alcohol education programs, but we didn't really have serious drug treatment programs. And we grew it from a small group of, like, say, 50 to over 900. And the LA County jail system had 18,000 people at the time. And when we did a survey, 85% of them had addiction issues. So that was an area that was a missed opportunity for us for years, but it was something that was controlled by the Board of Supervisors versus the Sheriff's Department. But when you bring in quality treatment in the jails, you stand a better chance of reducing the likelihood of recidivism when they go out. And when you link them, that treatment, you mean you do continuous treatment inside and outside, that increases the likelihood in the reduction of recidivism. So the solution to changing public policy was not to get rid of enforcement. The solution was to kind of trim that public policy tree and get better growth, better outcomes of the public policy instead of cutting the tree down, which is what the left has basically done. And here's the thing about this. It, when you look at the overdose and you look at who's dying, for example, it is Black men who are homeless that are the leading people that are dying on the streets in Los Angeles. And you see people of color dying of addiction. Now, the number one is, you know, white men generally die of overdoses more than anybody else, but percentage-wise, Black men are much higher percentage-wise. So this is not, the public policy that say is more equitable has not proven to be more equitable, no matter where you are. So I guess to focus, we can change public policy from what it was in the past, improve it, and get better outcomes without these blanket policies that we had with George Gascon, and we have Gascon that they had in Oregon, and we can see that are failing in Portugal.
And here's the dirty little secret about drugs. Drugs work. I'm a neurobiologist by training, and we have a pleasure center in our brain that is activated by cocaine, by opiates, by stimulants. Rats in studies have been given a choice between pressing a button and getting a pellet of food or a sip of water or getting some cocaine or another drug that's being studied. And they'll take the drug every single time until they die from either dehydration or starvation. Why? Because drugs work. It works even without drugs. If you put an electrode into the pleasure center, they'll punch the button and get the little electric zap instead of the food every single time until they die. So that's the problem we're up against. Drugs work. You're absolutely correct. Unless you pair enforcement with addiction treatment, there's no hope at all. And if you have a laissez-faire attitude, it's just going to create a situation straight out of Brave New World where people would go to work, they'd come home, they'd take their Soma pill, and they'd zone out until it was time to go to work the next morning. It's funny, Patrick. The Democrats are always against laissez-faire. They're always for government intervention, except when it comes to things like drugs.
Well, the interesting thing is on my show, I interviewed several of the candidates who were running against George Gascon, and one of them was Judge Craig Mitchell, and he started a program jogging or running through Skid Row. So he's kind of leans left, but he was frustrated with Gascon's policies because I laid out the whole drug stats in the lead up to his program. I do two segments, a short segment where I lay out just to talk about some stuff, and then I bring on the candidate or whoever I'm talking to. And he wanted to talk about that. What he said he noticed, and one of the reasons why he decided to speak out against Gascon, is in his courtroom, he used to have an option for somebody who wanted addiction treatment. But once George Gascon came to Los Angeles and stopped prosecuting, the drug courts that we had available folded because they didn't have any customers. See, the drug courts, they use that hook of going to jail versus getting treatment. And that all ended once you stopped filing drug and possession cases, right? So that's the number one thing he talked about. The other thing he talked about is he had a 22 kilo case where a guy was arrested for 22 kilos of methamphetamine. So that's like 44-ish pounds, I think. And that normally, when you have that kind of weight, you're doing state prison time. You're doing 5 to 10 years. Where just George Gascon dealt with as a simple possession case, the guy got 10 days. He got a slap on the wrist. And that so offended the judge. He said, because Gascon's running around saying he's doing his job, right? He's going after these dealers, but he's really not. So in addition to not helping the people who are addicted, he's not going after the people who are selling the poison. And that's why you're seeing the death rate skyrocket on overdoses. And you're exactly right. Fentanyl is 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin. So when these guys get hooked on it, the belief that they're going to somehow have an epiphany that they have to change their life is ludicrous. And somebody coming out there with a clipboard, a social worker saying, hey, you know what? I can help you. Now, I read a study out of Amsterdam, and we know Amsterdam had this kind of permissive policy on drugs, right? And, well, this study said, yeah, that's what they used to do. They would, nurses and social workers would go out, and what they realized is they would take whatever service they got from these guys, but they wouldn't leave. They wouldn't clean up their act. They wouldn't get treatment. And so then they brought the cops in, who used low-level summonses. And eventually, if they didn't deal with that summons, they were put in jail, and then they had the option. Now, I'll tell you, before I retired, I had an opportunity to help develop a program where the people had the option of going to jail. And this was in LA City. I know it's hard. I'm sheriff, but I had some connections. And so I was able to do some stuff for these guys to get it work. But I was part of this pilot program where you could get treatment or you can go to jail. And because LA City has its own city attorney, it could file misdemeanors still, right? And to date, they had 2,000 people, very small program, go through it. This was been in running for 4 years, and it's got a 93% success rate, which is pretty good. I mean, that's very good. But those are the kind of things we can do with good public policy, and we ignore the fairy tales, the rainbows, and the unicorns, like your last guest talked about, and stick with serious public policy.
And isn't it interesting that, you know, this all sort of started to come about, like you said, you know, fentanyl deaths were not a huge thing when Gascon came in. And here we are, you know, we had Prop 47 in California, we had Oregon do their thing. And now fentanyl deaths are, you know, peaking at 100,000 a year. It's like, yeah. I mean, how does that not play in? I mean, I guess it does play into it in some sense. Like, you know, the Chicago mayor basically called a state of emergency over it. And it's like, wow, only 2.5-3 years in, you're going to finally call a state of emergency. But is bringing it, the criminalization back at a misdemeanor level, is that enough, or is that going to just kind of put an easier PR sheen on it and sort of shift it to more like what we're seeing in LA and just let that run in perpetuity and let the fentanyl continue to just tear through?
Well, before Gascon got in office, Jackie Lacey was there, and they were still arresting, the deputies and police officers were still arresting for possession, and she was still filing those cases. So you still had an increase in overdose, but it was a flatter uptick, right? But as soon as Gascon got in and did the blanket policies where he's not going to file anything, you saw it spike. And that's the problem. Very much like what happened in Oregon. So we know that the public policy is bad and is driven purely by ideology. It's not driven by common sense. And that's the biggest part of the problem. Now, one of the things you talked about is the veneer of getting tough. So in Sacramento, Nancy Skinner, leftist, ultra-leftist lady up in San Francisco, she recently got a bill passed in a committee and in the state Senate where they want to get tougher on fentanyl. They want to get tougher on retail, selling of retail stolen goods and gun parts, you know, the ghost gun parts. But their way of doing it is to fine the online platforms where it's being sold. So they want to find them 200. They don't want to go after the people who are stealing. They don't want to go after the dealers. They don't want to go after the people that are you know, selling guns. They don't want to do that. They want to find the people who provide an online platform for the sales. And as long as that is the attitude that they're taking in Sacramento, as long as, you know, we're never going to get there. They do not want to go back to some of the old policies, the tough on drugs policies of the 90s and early 2000s. But some of those policies worked. So we have to bring those back. And then we have to look at our treatments, a regimen that did not work in the past, and rejigger those, and so that we get better outcomes. That's really the path forward. But it's never going to happen under Gascon because he's an ideologue. He's never going to change.
What do you think the odds of him not staying in office are? How does this election look? Do you think the judge has a chance? Are there other candidates that have a chance in unseating him? Because I can't imagine that he's very popular in LA.
He's not, you know, and, you know, I was tracking the race in Chicago, and it's similar. You know, we had two terms of Fox, and they're trying to replace her with an even further left candidate, Clayton Harris, and some Democratic judge, left of center Democratic judge, stood up and fought, and she got Republicans behind her, moderates behind her, independents behind her, moderate Democrats behind her, and she won the primary, and she's likely to be the new state's attorney in Chicago. So that's our third largest city. That's a big success for us who want good public policy and criminal justice. Gascon got 25%. I don't think his ceiling is going to go much higher than that. I mean, I was in the dentist chair for 2 hours this week, and my dentist said, who do you think's going to win? And I was talking, because I got Nathan Hochman coming on my show. He's the competition in the runoff against Gascon. And he says, well, we got his back. And this is a guy, he lives on the west side, his practice is in the San Fernando Valley, and he's been hitting me up about this race. This is the first time the guy ever talked to me about politics, right? So you can tell the anger and the frustration. And he said, hey, they finally got rid of the 12 homeless people around my dental practice. So people are angry, people are frustrated. I don't see guys going getting more than 30% of the vote. Even the Latinos, I think, are abandoning him.
Yeah, not surprised to see that. You know, and you were listening when Raymond Lopez was on. Anything strike you out of that Chicago conversation you want to comment on?
Well, you know, there were a couple things. I looked at all the latest shooting involved a guy named Dexter Reed. So uniform plainclothes guys pulled him over for a seatbelt violation. And I was looking at Chicago because they're having an uptick in deaths of traffic accidents. As we are in LA, I couldn't find all the data in LA to show this as clearly as they do in Chicago. But Chicago's 1/3 of it is black, but they have a disproportionately much higher number of deaths due to traffic accidents, yet they're demanding the police not do any more traffic stops. It's foolish because there's three ways to deal with people dying in traffic accidents. You re-engineer the street, which is hard to do in a legacy city like Chicago. You do education, which has limited impact, but you do enforcement. Enforcement is your number one tool. And when you stop using law enforcement to enforce traffic laws, you're going to have people dying of traffic accidents. The other thing, the more stops they do of people with guns, they take guns off the street. And that's exactly what they did in this case. The guy had a gun. He opened fire on the cops. They fired back. And this is very similar to the Ella French situation where the police officer was killed last year. She pulled over. It was a violation. I think it was a registration violation. Guy shot and seriously Almonte Morgan. I think seriously wounded her partner and shot and killed her. So you want your police officers taking the people with the guns off the street, the violent criminals with the guns off the street. But the Chicago leadership doesn't want anybody pulling anybody over. You want to stop the deaths and destruction, but the Chicago leader doesn't want the cops pulling anybody over, even for simple traffic violations. So they need to make up their mind. You know, I heard one saying I heard, and I think it's apropos for Chicago. The best thing to do for a liberal to change their mind is give them what they want. And I think that is what's going on in Chicago. They got what they wanted, and it's a disaster. Instead of utopia, they got dystopia, right? So,
well, as we used to say in New York, the definition of a conservative is a liberal that's been mugged. So there's that too. Chief Patrick Jordan, can't thank you enough. folks, you can follow the chief on X at LASD Jordan. That's LASD JORDAN. And that's it for tonight's State of the Nation. Stay tuned here on today's News Talk for the Jason Burmish Show. For Brian Hesher McLean, I'm Timothy Shea. Until next time, God bless you. God bless these United States. Keep fighting the good fight.